Well, welcome. Oh, that's very loud. Welcome to
Trending Now
with Josh Arnold on MSO News Sports. I'm Rick Moore, along with our producer and engineer, Bill Proposky, and today's host, as usual on a Friday, is Josh Arnold. Hello.
Hello there.
What's up?
Well, the Patriots didn't win, so.
Now, all the talk will be about because Brady's so old. I mean, you know, he looked just awful. The whole team looked pretty bad last night, I got to say. So anyway, yeah, Brady will be back, not to worry. What's on our schedule today?
We have Bob Cronin, who is a candidate for mayor in Newburyport. He's a current Ward 3 councillor and multi-term councillor there. Domingo Dominguez is a candidate for city council in Salem. And then Laurie Stevens is a social media strategist with a criminal focus, who's going to be joining us as our third guest.
Social media strategist. I actually heard an advertisement online for courses or a degree in social media now in college.
There you go.
Freaky stuff, freaky stuff. Okay, we'll be right back.
People come in, take a seat. You're really in for a treat at Sylvan Street. A great place to eat and drink and meet with family and friends at Sylvan Street. We'll treat you right, day or night. Satisfy your appetite. Eat, drink, and chill at the Sylvan Street Grill.
Catch a game with friends, meet for lunch, cocktails after work, or a romantic dinner for two. Whatever your plan, plan to do it at Sylvan Street Grill in Peabody and Salisbury. See you at Sylvan Street.
Eat, drink, and chill at the Sylvan Street Grill.
If you are interested in replacing your home's kitchen cabinets, please see the kitchen cabinet showrooms at any of Moynihan Lumber's three locations in North Reading, Beverly, or Plaistow, New Hampshire, or at MoynihanLumber.com.
Moynihan Lumber, we measure up.
Stronger, faster, tougher. When you need the MVP of community banks, look no further than the Institution for Savings, with 14 full-service offices throughout the North Shore. We have MVP rates and an all-star team to serve you. Bank from the ball field with our 24/7 online application apps, internet banking, mobile deposit, and more. Institution for Savings, your winning team. Visit institutionforsavings.com, member FDIC, DIF, equal housing lender. MSO, newsports.com is your connection to North Shore news and sports. Local video and radio interviews, photos, and much more. And a daily local radio newscast on North Shore Today.
Welcome back to Trending Now with Josh Arnold. Our first guest is Robert Cronin, a candidate for mayor of the city of Newburyport. Bob, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for having me again, Josh. Nice to talk to you again.
I guess I want to start out. We usually start out giving me a 3 or 4 minute bio, then we can get into some questions.
I've lived in Newburyport approximately 30 years. I've been a city councilor for the last 4 terms, 2-year terms, almost 8 years. I'm chair of public safety, and I've been on budget and finance for the last 8 years. Privately, I'm a retired police officer, though most people have no idea that that was my career. I spent 26 plus years in Andover and then moved on to the sheriff's office, where I ran their sheriff's investigation unit until my retirement. I have a security consulting business that mainly consists of investigating boat accidents, and that's at a national level. I travel the country doing that, and I also do some security consulting as far as buildings and things like that, as far as alarms, cameras, policies, and procedures.
Good.
So that's pretty much where I am, married and living with my wife happily on the Merrimack River.
Great. Bob, what motivated you to run for mayor this year?
You know, I love the city. This is one of the gems of the United States. And, you know, as I said, I've been a city councilor for about four terms. And it's just gotten to the point where I think that the process in Newburyport needs to change. I truly believe that there's a disconnect between the folks, the residents, and the businesses, and City Hall and city government, and that has to change. I'm certainly concerned about losing our middle class in our affordable housing stock, and those are some of the reasons that I've really made the decision to go to the next level.
Okay, great. How would you describe the relationship between the Newburyport City Council and the mayor's office over the past term?
I believe we all want the best for the city. My 8 years on council has been concurrent with the sitting mayor. And in the last year, 2 years, maybe even three, the dynamic has seemed to have changed significantly. There's not enough collaboration between the council and the mayor. The communication is lacking. And as a result, there's been, in my opinion anyway, a significant disconnect. Not getting too far down the rabbit hole, I do have five other city councilors that have endorsed me, so this isn't just a single stance. There seems to be a change dynamic. Let's okay. just leave it at that.
If elected, how would your administration be different? What are the areas that are not getting a focus? Are you likely to focus on? What approaches taken by the current administration are you most likely to either alter or change?
I think that in our brief conversation, you can already see that my first and foremost would be a collaborative approach and more communication at every level. I think that's the first thing. The second thing, I try to get back into the neighborhoods. The neighborhoods, the residents are paying 90% of our freight, and they aren't really getting an equal share of the services, be it sidewalk, be it schools, be it roads. And so we have to change that. That has to turn around. I think I'm the person to do that. I also want to focus on our industrial park, and I used the term industrial on purpose. It was a manufacturing only park. It was a lot of clean businesses, but it was building things. It's getting a little bit long in the tooth, and the council on its own has changed the zoning down there to change it into a business park. Right now it's a business park, arguably in name only. If I were to take office, one of my focuses would be to turn the park around, get more business in there, change the activity down there, make it more vibrant, and that certainly goes a long way to helping the rest of the city, because now you have businesses that are going out and they're spending money either shopping or eating or just recreating in town. So that's just a short version of what some of my visions are.
Yeah. One of the things that's happened this year is the passage of the marijuana law, and it's creating issues up and down across the Commonwealth, really, with city councils and school city administrations, whether it's zoning or permitting or where you could put that. There's a banking level issue. The banks are still under the federal laws, and they can't accept money from that came from the sale of drugs. What are some of the issues that are happening in Newburyport, and what are your thoughts on them?
Okay, in Newburyport, it's really not as big of an issue as in some other communities. We overwhelmingly passed by vote, our vote as far as supporting decriminalization of marijuana. So in that aspect, I think the voters have spoken. We have created, the city council has created a dispensary district, which is down actually in our business park. We've had, to my knowledge, no real serious inquiries into moving a dispensary into the community. But if that were the case, I believe that our city police department is more than trained and more than professional enough to handle that, and certainly would have community forums and discussions. But I think that as of this point, it's a real non-issue in this community.
Okay, great. I was reading the police notes in a local Metropolitan Daily, the Gloucester Daily Times, and Essex, a man got a citation for having an open bag of marijuana in the backseat of his car, and they said it's not a criminal offense, it's a civil offense, but it's a $500 fine. I'm just wondering, how much does that apply everywhere? Or is that just Essex, or is anybody that has a bag that's not, real sealed all the way?
I not knowing all the facts and circumstances of the case, I would only be speculating, but that seems to me as though that was kind of akin to an open container of alcohol in a car.
Yeah.
It's totally legal, but it should be secured in some way, and obviously in the officer's view, it was in such a way that perhaps somebody was imbibing while driving, but I'm just speculating.
What do you think are the most significant issues that are going to be debated in this year's mayoral and council races in Newburyport, and which of those do you think are going to make up the agenda for the next term of office?
Okay, I'm going to give I'm pretty versed on this one, so I'll shoot them right out to you in no order. Overdevelopment and what we call in Newburyport infill. And infill is the splitting of lots or splitting a house into from a single family to a two-family, a three-family. And what this is doing is it's really affecting our infrastructure with consequences like losing green space and parking in our congested areas of the downtown. So that's overdevelopment and infill is on the list. Education is always on the list. How do you fund the schools? How do you get the most bang for your buck? And how do you replace programs that have been lost due to federal and state budget cuts over the years? And then finally, I would say taxes and finances are always on the forefront of many, many people's minds. And while, I guess everything is certain with death and taxes, you can look at finances and projects and say, hey, we have to prioritize better and we have to do a better job in spending our money and where we spend it and how we spend it. So I think those are the three general areas that we really have to address.
The city's website, how websites are becoming more and more an instrument of how a city does its business. There are ways to do online transactions. It's the menu guide for city government, but it's also a way of showcasing to people outside of Newburyport what Newburyport has to offer. How satisfied are you with the website and how well it's maintained? How accurate or current is the information that's posted on it? And what, if anything, would you change or do better?
I try to make it easier to navigate. There's a lot of good information on there. Much of it looks nice. If you're somebody researching the report, say, to visit here, I think it's a great resource, a great tool. If you're looking far as a tool for a resident. I think it has to be a little more user-friendly and provide better access to online services. I think we also have to use it more liberally to alert citizens to emergencies or events. And, you know, we have, obviously, as everybody else knows, snow events that we have parking bans and the like. But, you know, we're one of the more unique communities where, you know, sometimes Plum Island is cut off, and that has to be communicated. Sometimes there are other events, and even, you know, police/security events that from time to time happen that we can utilize either Code Red or our website to get the message out. So I think there's a lot of things that we could improve on getting information to our residents.
Great. Well, I want to thank you for being a guest on Trending Now with Josh Arnold, and wish you the very best of luck in your political pursuit of the mayoralship of the city of Newburyport.
All right, thank you so much for calling, and hope to talk to you soon, Josh.
Thanks, Bob.
Thanks.
Harrington's Trophy and Awards has been rewarding the North Shore for over 25 years. Hi, I'm Kevin Harrington.
And I am Marty Harrington, and we are known for our local family business, providing custom trophies, plaques, screen printing, embroidery, and much more. We offer a variety of services such as engraving wedding gifts, medals for charity walks, youth sports trophies, and uniforms. From the newest style performance wear to your everyday work shirts, we are your one-stop shop. Whether it's a fantasy football, warm-up suits for your team, end-of-the-year banquet gifts, or recognizing excellence, we pride our business on our exceptional customer service and quality products. Located in Lynn, or visit our website at harringtontrophy.com.
The Gloucester House Restaurant at historic Seven Seas Wharf, 63 Rogers Street, Gloucester. This is owner Lenny Linquata.
We provide service and product better than anybody else. It comes directly from our boats right to your plate. We have fishermen that work great for us. We are wholesalers that we buy what we want to serve to our customers, and we put the rest of it right out in the market.
The Gloucester House Restaurant. Visit thegloucesterhouse.com.
This is the freshest seafood you can get from our boats to your plate.
A great way to monitor what's happening on the North Shore? Get the MSO New Sports app. A click here, a click there, you're listening or watching North Shore football. And check out the latest stories on our webpage, msonewsports.com.
Welcome back to Trending Now with Josh Arnold. Our next guest is Domingo Dominguez, who is a candidate for City Councilor at Large in Salem, Mass. Domingo, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Josh, and thank you for having me on your show. It's a great pleasure for me. Thank you.
We usually start out to ask our guests to do the 3 or 4 minute bio, and then we could ask you some questions about the race and your positions and so forth. So why don't we start there?
Great. My name is Domingo. I'm running for City Council at Large in the city of Salem. I'm a native from Dominican Republic. I'm a Dominican American. I came from Dominican Republic to the United States 33 years ago, living in New Jersey, and then after that I went to school in Tennessee, had a bachelor's degree in business, and after I finished my college, I moved to Salem, where I was granted a position as an elementary school teacher. Two-way bilingual. I'm married with my wife, Becky Dominguez, for more than 25 years. And I have seven beautiful children, very responsible, from different ages. My past experience include business owner for more than 10 years, and also a elementary school teacher. I've been involved in my community for many, many years and in many capacities. I recently was the president for the Latino Business Association, I'm not sure. And I also been member of the board of directors of the Selling YMCA, the board of directors of the Selling Asset TV, and the board of directors and vice president of the board for the Selling Harbor CDC, an organization that has been in the community for many, many years, helping low-income families to get housing. I also preceded or was president for the Latino Festival in two occasions, 2 years consecutive. But I be involved in many others capacity. You know, I'm member of the executive board for the South Salem Neighborhood Association. I also was member of the Rotary Club in Salem for many years, and be able to help all the time. When I grew up, my mom taught me how to be involved in my community, and not only being involved, but able to help others. My mom is a pastor. I'm Christian myself. I'm very involved with my church, local church, and my involvement and my experience as a community active helped me not only to know the issue, but also to be able to sit down on the table and bring some solution, fresh, a new idea. So that's basically who I am. I'm a very care person. I care about my city. I care about my neighborhood. And I also wanted to inspire others so they can get motivated, so they can get involved in their own community. And they can always, you know, give something back. This is an opportunity for me as a candidate, as if, when I get elected, to give something to my community that has given me too much. But I wanted to teach, I wanted to inspire, and I wanted to be able to show the new generation that no matter how many times you fail, when you have a passion, you have to continue to go you need to continue to maintain your persistence and make sure that the time that you fail, you use it as a fuel so you can raise up. With my campaign as a counselor at large, I'm hoping that I can inspire others to become active, like I mentioned before, and to, you know, get something back. Sailing, interior sailing has been great to me. I received so many great opportunities. I raised my family here, and I love sailing, and I care about my people.
Great. Well, you've already answered like my first three questions, so that's great. I, you know, we're going to ask you about why you ran, but that certainly you covered that. I want to talk about a couple of issues. There's been a lot of talk about Salem becoming or being a sanctuary city. How prevalent is that an issue in Salem, and what are your thoughts on it?
Great. That's a great question. Let me tell you that that's an issue that has been addressing in so many ways, and I've been answering the same way I'm going to be answering to you today. As I mentioned to you, I'm a native of the Dominican Republic and a new immigrant, and I feel this ordinance is about humanity, dignity, and respect for others, but overall it's about love. However, I believe that the way it's been handling the city of Salem has been run by both sides, the one that opposed and the one that are in favor. I believe that some people, not the majority, but some of the people, some of the elected officials in both sides, they're using the sanctuary city issue as a political tool, and they both run. Like I mentioned to you, this is a humanity issue that needs to be dealt as a human. So I feel that that never should happen before. I think that the right way, the right approach or that issue supposed to be the way it is right now is left on the hand of the voters so they can decide it. They will decide it yes or no depending on how they feel on that issue that is human. Me as a elected official, when I get elected, I will respect anyone's decision. But if you ask me my personal opinion, I support the Santori City because of the reason that I told you in front, because it's a human issue, it's a respect for others, and we need to make sure that we welcome everyone and everybody feel welcome in the city of Salem.
The sanctuary city issue is it blends into another issue, and that is that it blends into many other issues. But part of that is that the way the federal government has historically gone about its business is to use in Massachusetts part of Proposition 2.5 when it was passed. Decades ago, it had a clause in it there would be no more unfunded mandates. Well, they did find ways to get around that on certain things, but the federal government has no such requirement. And they don't approach it that way. They simply approach it from the vantage point of if you don't follow the laws the way we live, we're going to pull out the funding that we do from the federal government. Now, I'm an advocate for children with special needs, is one of the things that I do, and I've used that to schools to say, hey, if you're not providing the right education for this child, I'm going to file a complaint. And the threat of that sometimes moves the school district to go ahead and put the IEP in place that's going to with the service that's going to help that child. That's always been the hammer, the carrot and the hammer kind of thing that's worked on many issues, not just immigration. But it's just been since the president was elected or before he was elected that became an issue with immigration, and we sanctuary city became a household term. Is that your sense of it?
Yeah, I'm very concerned about that too. I've been asked that question before, and this is what I think about it. I think that the way the ordinance in Salem is being written, I don't think that we will lose any funding. I don't think that we'll qualify for.
Yeah, all the feds, if you want to call them that, were saying that I took away from it was, we want you to follow the law. And if you don't follow the law, these are the consequences. But it wasn't so much about... So if the law enforcement in Salem... if there's an outstanding warrant for somebody, they have to cooperate.
I do understand. And I think that, the Salem police, in this case, they've been respecting the law. I mean, there's nothing that say... the ordinance that they will not respect the law. They're going to continue to do what they have done.
Yeah. There's no change in policy here. It's just, this is what we've always done. It's just, it's been blown up and it starts to take on a dimension and life of its own, and people see it as something that really doesn't have to be.
Yeah, I hear that, and that's a big concern. Obviously, losing money is always a concern. I feel the same way. I mean, school, as a teacher and as a parent, I see that if we're losing any funds, it's going to be hurting us.
But Salem could face the same kinds of consequences if it didn't have the right kind of sewering and water outflow system that the federal government mandates. It's not a function of, it isn't strictly an immigration issue. This is, the problem that could happen under any number of tents, if you will, from a client standpoint. So, yeah,
I agree. That, and that's why I'm concerning about the way it's been handled, because I think that some people are using it as political tools, and they don't really helping people understand the issue and make sure that they really, stand up for the right reason, because they paint in a way that people don't understand. And that's my concern about it. But like I say, I will be advocating for not only on the sanctuary city, but in any other issue that affect people's life. I think that we need to make sure that we, as elected officials representing people in all capacity, we need to talk about the seniors who are one of the more vulnerable population. And in Salem, we have a lot of seniors, and we need to make sure that we attend. them because they did it for us. It's about time that we do for them. So eventually, I'm going to be a very strong voice representing, you know, the most needed one in the city of Salem, regardless of what title the political people are giving to them. We need to make sure that we represent people.
Great. Which leads me to my next question, and that was, yesterday was the groundbreaking ceremony for the new senior center for the Council on Aging. Tell us about how that went and what your thoughts are on providing services for the elderly.
Let me tell you, Jos, that this issue has been in the air for so many years. I don't know if you know, but this is going to be my fourth time running for City Council at large. And every election year, we hear the same topic, senior center. I have a very good story about it. When I started campaign, I met such a very great lady. And she mentioned to me and said, listen, I'm not a senior yet. And I'm wanting to see a senior center to build up when I become a senior. Well, I told her, actually, if I get elected, I'm going to be working in that because I had a lot of passion into that. My mom is a senior. I have many family members and good close friends that are seniors, and I see their need. And happened that I was not elected. I went in my second campaign, and I met the same person, and she told me, hey, when you came in, I was almost a senior, but now I'm a senior. What's going to happen with the senior center? I say, I'm not elected. We're going to try to help the possible way. And I think they're talking about it. They're going to have it. In my third campaign, when I come to her again, she told me, you know what? You told me the same thing, and I know, senior center. I think they're waiting for me to die before they build the senior center. That's how long they've been talking about. But let me tell you that, in my opinion, what is happening on the senior center building is that in some cases they're still using that topic, that issue, as a political issue too, as a political tool, because they've been bringing it up every election day. But when election passed, they forget about it and they put it somewhere. I'm going to be working very hard. I'm going to be a very strong voice, making sure that happened. Happily, yesterday they did the first thing that they need to do. Hopefully, they don't going to drop the ball in that stage. We need to continue to work hardly, making sure that we build a house for our senior.
Great. Well,
it is about time that we do it. We need to start the political talking, and we need to do what people need to be done. And I think that in some cases, I hear some people say, this is the wrong side, and that's the wrong developers. But I believe that we already spent so much resources, so much brain, so much time into that we need to move forward. We need to have it done. We need to make it happen. When I get elected, that's going to be top of my priority, making sure that we build a senior center. But not only that, I'm going to be informing all of the senior people about the progress, when we have done anything wrong, and when we have progress in the building or making that happen. So I'm going to be a strong voice on that.
Great. Well, I want to thank you for being a guest on Trending Now with Josh Arnold. We certainly wish you the very best of luck in your work with the many volunteer organizations and your bid for city council in this coming election.
Thank you, Josh, and I want to just remind people that the preliminary election is going to be September 12th, and I humbly ask for one of you for a vote. I'd be happy to represent you, and I will guarantee you that I will know. I will not disappoint you, because I'm going to be working very hard to make sure that you really be well represented. Thank you so much and have a good day.
Thank you, Domingo. Take care.
Take care. Bye.
The Bradford Tavern in Raleigh is unique, with modern touches in a rustic setting, offering the finest steaks, the freshest seafood, and many quality daily specials. Serving lunch and dinner, the Bradford Tavern is open Tuesday through Sunday, 11:30 a.m. to midnight, closed Mondays. The restaurant features two separate function rooms ideal for every need, including business meetings, bridal and baby showers, or any special event. The Bradford Tavern is located at 87 Haverhill Street, Route 133 in Raleigh, and online at bradfordtavern.com.
If you are interested in replacing your home's kitchen cabinets, please see the kitchen cabinet showrooms at any of Moynihan Lumber's three locations in North Reading, Beverly, or Plastow, New Hampshire, or at MoynihanLumber.com.
Moynihan Lumber, we measure up.
Be sure to check out North Shore Sports Night every Monday night at 7. The North Shore Sports Talk Show with Rick Moore and Tim Kearns. NSONewsSports.com is known for connecting North Shore sports fans with local sports newsmakers. Features on teams and players. Exclusive video interviews following the big games. Live event coverage such as high school football, basketball, hockey, and baseball. Live video coverage of the Gloucester Fiesta. MSO also connects you to the area news leaders, mayors, state representatives, state senators, town administrators, city and town elected officials, business leaders, and more. Entertainment features. Follow us on Twitter or Facebook at MSO News Sports. Email us at msonewsports@gmail.com. Leave a voice message anytime, 978-325-3638. Stay connected to your North Shore neighbors by simply clicking on msonewsports.com.
Welcome back to Trending Now with Josh Arnold. Our next guest is Laurie Stevens, who is a social media strategist. She belongs to a number of organizations. Her clients have included the Toronto Police Service, the Dallas Police Service, and I just saw a flash that the Dallas Police Department is about to get its first woman police chief.
Isn't that fantastic?
Yeah. So welcome to the program, and tell us, we usually start out and tell us about, give us your 3 or 4 minute bio, and then we can get into some questions about the good work that you do.
Oh, thank you so much, Josh. This is really cool for me to join you on your program today. I do social media, and I do it exclusively with police. Probably what I'm most known for is the Smile Conference. I created that back in 2009. We held the first one in 2010 in Washington, and we're just getting ready to produce the 15th Smile Conference, and that'll be in May of next year in Miami, assuming Miami is still there after this hurricane we're watching these days. And, of course, our thoughts and prayers go out to everyone down there. And I do a lot of training and consulting, as you mentioned, with law enforcement as well, but purely in the area of social media. I'm starting to expand now into, I offer a lot of investigations training, but we're starting to get into darknet training and cell phone investigations and things like that. So a little bit outside of social media, but very much in the realm of digital technologies and investigations.
Now, SMILE conference, SMILE stands for Social Media, Internet, and Law Enforcement, right? Did I get that right?
That's absolutely correct.
And so what is it that you do? I mean, I know a piece of the social media is has to do with the community and reaching out to the community, public affairs, community service, and the interaction between law enforcement and the community. But I also know that there's more to it than that. Tell us about how that works.
Well, I mean, community outreach is definitely one of the ways that law enforcement uses social media to better connect with people, but also for just, public relations and just telling their own stories. One of the reasons I came down this path was 'cause years ago I saw that first responders of all kinds just really didn't do a very good job telling their own stories. And so I tried to help them 30 years ago, before we had social media, just to do a better job at telling their own stories. So now they've got social media because it doesn't cost. I mean, it costs them resources, it costs them people, but it doesn't cost anything for the technology. They don't need a marketing budget, for example. They use it for public relations, or they'll use it to, educate the public on safety issues, whether it be traffic or just, if they have a drug breaking and break and enterings happening in a certain neighborhood or what have you, just notifying them, educating people. They'll solicit tips or information identities of people through social media. I've seen cases where they'll just put out a photo and say, hey, this is what happened. We don't have any leads. Help us out. And the public will take it upon themselves to hand them the suspects within a matter of hours. So it's just, it really runs the gamut. And it's a very powerful, powerful tool for law enforcement.
I know that two of the local mayors on the North Shore, Kim Driscoll, the mayor of Salem, and Safathia Romeo Taken, the mayor of Gloucester, are prolific users of social media. And any time something happens in the city, either city, you can expect that they're going to be posting something, whether it's a power outage to the water main break to their repaving, and you need to reroute. And but all of that you never saw that before. I mean, that's all new. I mean,
Well, I mean, and they're smart to do that because that's how they can maintain control of the story. Because sometimes if it's a little more controversial than a water main break, if it's a controversial story, there may be a group that would try to spread false rumors or whatever. But by getting out there first and really controlling the story, that's the way to go. But also, the local news doesn't usually cover that.
Right.
Or, you know, if they do, it's at 6 o'clock and it's 1 o'clock in the afternoon and you need to tell people right now. And so now they have the power right now to break their own news. It's just plain smart to do that.
You know, I have to ask, and it wasn't part of those things that we talked about in the preview, but it occurred to me afterwards. If they had social media in 1963 in Dallas, how much would history have changed?
Yeah, you never know. They might have had, video of everything going down and everything. That's incredible.
Yeah.
For sure.
What now I know that a big piece of the social media is sharing information, and it's created opportunities for law enforcement to share with other law enforcement agencies or other geographic areas. And I'm guessing there are pluses and minuses to that. Can you walk us through some of those things?
Well, as far as I think what you're talking about is just how our worlds have shrunk and connecting officers with one another.
Yeah.
And so, all of our worlds are smaller now because we connect with people on the other side of the planet. And sometimes that's done purely through social media. I think more commonly, I think it's a combination of, connecting in social and then meeting at an event, and I see that happen all the time through my events or other events where law enforcement connects with people, or even we run a global police tweet-a-thon, and we've run it 5 or 6 times now, but it's a tweet-a-thon that solicits participation from law enforcement all over the world. And after the first one, I remember a lot of the commentary was, holy cow, they're dealing with, from a police officer, they're dealing with the same problems in Australia as we are here in, Bristol, UK, so it's really remarkable, the eye-opening that happens. But also, law enforcement is realizing, especially the investigative side, that criminals don't stick to borders, because social media knows no borders, and so now, it's just easier to track a case because of the digital trail. It's easier now to make connections with the police officer maybe 1 or 2 states away because your suspect, left a trail and the crime happened across 2 or 3 states. And so it's just, everything's easier and faster. But I tell you, there's no crime committed these days, I'm told by my investigators, that doesn't involve social media in some way.
Wow, what's a powerful statement. There's no crime committed today that doesn't involve social media in some way.
There's some sort of digital evidence. There's something in just about every crime that's there today.
So
it behooves investigators to know where to look and how to look, right?
Right. So when You know, and we talked about this before, but the you know, people watch Criminal Minds, for example, and they have the woman who's the magician with the computers and can go hack into anything, any database, and that's not real. I mean, that's Hollywood's version of what happens, but that's not. We still have the, you know, search and seizure and all of that, and the Miranda and all of that that you have to do. So, I mean, you know, I'm sure that. Even though there are breakthrough opportunities with technology, law enforcement people still have to follow the law. So it's
exactly
the error on the side of caution. People are going to be mindful that, you know, they don't want to, you know, get to court or superior court and something gets thrown out because of a technicality. So
exactly, I think every agency wishes they had one of those magicians.
Yeah.
But sadly, they don't. And your point is correct that they do need to err on the side of caution. And, you know, cops want to put bad guys behind jail. That's at the end of the day, that's what they live for, right? And so they're not, for the most part, they're not out there, you know, like the wild, wild west and just running wild and doing whatever they can get away with in the social media world. If anything, they are doing exactly what you mentioned, is erring on the side of caution, because they don't want their case to fall apart. They don't want to get to court and just on some little technicality, or because they can't explain something. You know, even though the data that the intelligence that they're presenting is solid, they can't explain why, and they can't explain why there's proof of it. Then they could lose the case just for that, you know. So there's a lot that they need to know. And, you know, what we're seeing is that a lot of these guys and girls are self-taught, and so therefore they may not always be following what we would call best practices, right? So what we see often is they're being overly cautious to guard someone's privacy, for example. Not necessarily what you hear about in the news, you know, with the civil liberties. Organizations are often, for good reason, crying foul because they think law enforcement is doing this, that, and the other thing. Sometimes they are, but the day in, day out, average investigator is being extremely cautious in social media and scrambling to learn what the best practices are so that their cases don't fall apart, right?
Yeah.
So we're starting to see these best practices being established, and certainly we like to think of law as communications. We're having a hand in establishing what those techniques are, and we're seeing that they're being shared, and hopefully, you know, we'll see the profession maturing in that way.
How do so if I'm Joe Schmo and I have my Facebook or account or Twitter account, and I log on or whatever, I don't log on, am I right in assuming that someone from a law enforcement can look at my account and say, or, you know, there's a pattern there, that whether it's an IP code or whether it's an IP address or what have you, they'll know when I've been on or not been on, or how much time I've been there, or how does that play out?
Well, I think the only way they're going to know that is if they have access to your account, and the only way they're going to get access to your account is with a warrant, or if they have, I have seen cases where they'll get access to an account through somebody else who has access to an account. It's sort of akin to a confidential informant sort of situation. But otherwise, they're not going to be able to necessarily see when you logged on and when you logged off, unless they subpoena the records from Facebook, for example. Then they can see all of that. But Facebook does not make that easy for law enforcement. So for the most part, law enforcement's only going to see what's publicly available.
Okay.
You know, there are ways to search that are legal for law enforcement to see things that have been posted by people that may be behind a firewall. But it's a rare situation, and for the most part, they're only going to see what you've posted publicly, unless they have, you know, good enough reason, and they run a search warrant and they get access to your account that way.
Okay. You mentioned the tweet-a-thon, I thought, if that's the right term. I'm intrigued by that. Tell us more about what that was, what it is, and how it developed, and what it's
developed one day because I was talking to some friends who were at a very small agency, and they were like, well, we'd like to have a tweet-a-thon, but they have, like, you know, six officers and nothing happens in their town, and they just didn't think the idea would be, you know, a big event, and that they just didn't really think that their citizens would be all that interested in what they were tweeting, and but they wanted to participate. And I said to them, well, why not have like a, you know, a regional one? Like, why not partner with your local agencies or, you know, something like that? And they kind of poo-pooed that idea. And I thought, you know what? I'll organize something. And actually had the idea, but then it sort of percolated for about a year before I actually rolled it out. And then
so how did you do it?
Media just put it out there, you know, because I have an extensive network internationally. I mean, I pretty much touch every continent, but, you know, I'm not real strong in Asia or in the Middle East, but I even have some contacts in those parts of the world. And we just put it out in social media, and it picked up. And I would say the first one we had was probably the biggest one we had. And you know what? You know when you go to a football game, you see the wave go around the stadium?
Yeah.
That's what we saw happening with trending on Twitter. So our hashtag for the tweet-a-thon is poll tweet, POLTWT for police tweet. And we literally saw it trend from the first part of the world it started in, which was New Zealand. And it trended in New Zealand, and then it trended in Australia, and then it just moved right across the world like that. And it hit Eastern Europe, and then across Europe, and into the UK, and then, you know, Iceland, and it moved right across North America like that. It was fantastic.
And people were...
I'm sorry, and so
people in law enforcement in all of those places were sending in tweets about a particular issue, or
we tell them there's no rules. You know, you can tweet your calls. Sometimes they tweet all the calls they get in, or sometimes they'll have one or two or three officers tweet the beat that they're on that day, or sometimes they'll choose a particular topic. Maybe an agency is really trying to get the word out about domestic violence, for example, and so they'll just decide that on the day of the tweet-a-thon, they're just going to tweet about domestic violence. And so that's, you know, they develop their own strategy individually, and we also have individual officers tweeting whatever they want to tweet. There's no rule. And then we see a whole lot of playful gesturing among them from one part of the world to the next, and I think it's just really eye-opening, and the first few especially got a lot of media attention. So it just, I think people have an opportunity to really see what police do every day. I think in most instances, people are really surprised to know that, you know, that how busy they are and the kinds of situations that they have to take care of. And it was just fantastic all the way around. We're looking at doing another one at the end of next month.
Oh, great. What how much... exposure do you have to the analytics or statistics of who uses what, and you know which medium people are using? Is it, for example, I'm told that people that use Facebook are the majority are 45 and up, but people who use some other one, you know, younger people will use something else.
No, that's pretty much right. I mean, those kinds of statistics are usually, when you're looking at just overall the general population, I usually go to a place like Pew Internet, so pewinternet.org. You can go there, and they just got all tons of information about, you know, they run a study every year on what social media platforms people are using, which ones are growing, and which age category, which economic level, which educational level, male versus female, all of that. It's all there. And then when I work with agencies, so for example, in Dallas, we did a survey, and we had 1,754 people respond. And we broke it down like that as well, so we could see how big, you know, Twitter is in Dallas, so we know how much of the strategy we should really be emphasizing Twitter, and so forth and so on. And we also then studied other things as well. But, so those kinds of analytics, generally overall, we get from Pew, but then I generate my own when I go into a specific geographic area.
Great. What, just take a look at the time. What are some of the other issues that you see with social media in the criminal justice system that you might want to chat about?
Well, I mean, one thing that occurred to me, and we're just talking about analytics and statistics and all of that, one thing that I always point out to my groups that I'm training is that there's a study, and I duplicated it in Dallas, the same number. Approximately 88% of the people surveyed will say they want to help police prevent and solve crime. And I'll ask these groups, you know, what percentage of your audience right now do you think are really helping you? And the answer is usually somewhere between 5% and 10%. And so the reality is that maybe with social media, and if we're really strategic about it, and that's key because most agencies are not strategic about it, but if they really look at and do some of that studies like we've done, and ask their people where, you know, how they want to receive information and what kind of information they want to receive in those ways, and they try to, you know, develop a strategy around it, they can get closer to the 88%. Like, are we ever going to get to 88%? I hope one day we will really have 88% of all citizens tapped into keeping their communities safe. But we can sure do a whole lot better than 5 or 10% right now, you know, if they're just a little bit more strategic about it.
What kinds of issues are law enforcement dealing with in terms of people who use social media to give false information?
That's a huge area.
Yeah.
You know, it's also one of those areas that's sort of matured. I think in the beginning, law enforcement really fell for a lot of things, you know, that were just false, and they weren't necessarily as savvy as they might have been, or as they would be today. For example, even in the Boston bombing there in Massachusetts, when suspect number two created a false account, law enforcement wasn't exactly on the spot with realizing it was a false account at first.
Yeah.
You know, I and others were listening to the scanners, and they were putting it out there as a threat, and it really wasn't. It was just some guy, you know, who created the account that day and sent out three tweets, and they didn't necessarily see that. But they're getting more savvy about that sort of thing right now. But the unfortunate thing is where we're seeing things like, you know, in Ferguson, that whole hands up, don't shoot, that took hold, and that grew, and it just really worked against law enforcement, and we learned, you know, 10 months later that it was false. It wasn't even real.
Yeah.
And yet law enforcement, if they knew at the time what was going on and they were using social media, perhaps they could have countered it. But they weren't ready. You know, they got hammered. It's not well known, but the biggest situation how this happened was in North Dakota over the last year with the pipeline going in. The war that was waged, it wasn't just a accidental thing that happened, that somebody happened to say something against law enforcement and it grew, but it was actually a very organized, strategic. They had an army of at least 30 people who did nothing but social media attacks on law enforcement, on this tiny sheriff's department of 23 deputies in Morton County in North Dakota, and the family's safety were threatened. It was just a huge and significant threat on people's lives there, all in social media. And Morton County Sheriff didn't know what hit them, you know, and so my team went in sort of late, did some triage, and got it turned around a little bit. But, you know, it's just bad to me because we've told law enforcement for years now, this is going to happen to you. It's not a matter of whether it's going to happen to you.
It's when.
It's a matter of when,
yep.
Right? And so you can be ready. You can be ready right now. You know, so now I'm working with others along the path of the pipeline. It isn't for law enforcement. If they were treating them as though they were digging the pipeline. It's not about being pro-pipeline. I'm not necessarily pro-pipeline. It doesn't really matter what I am or what
yep.
the cops are. They're just there to protect public safety, but they're being attacked as though they were responsible for the pipeline.
Yeah.
And so it's just nuts, you know. So now we're working with agencies in other parts of the Midwest to try to be more strategic and to be ready because they're going to get hit. I think even though with the training and the work I've done so far, I think we still don't even realize the magnitude of what's going to hit there.
Well, I want to thank you for being a guest on Trending Now with Josh Arnold. We probably should have allocated some more time because I've got several more questions that I wanted to ask. But yeah, but thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule. And maybe we can have you on again, and we can tackle the rest of the things that we haven't talked about.
Anytime, Josh.
Great. Thank you. Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right, we got to get out of here. Very late. What do you got coming up?
More of the political people running for office and more people of different interests.
Okay, all right. You're all done. Okay, that'll do it. Football tonight, check it out. MSO News Sports. For Josh Arnold, our producer and engineer, Bill Proposky, I'm Rick Moore.